Some time back, I thought that I would give one of my son-in-laws a special treat. It was before I moved here. And I thought, I decided I would take him to my favorite fishing spot. It wasn't my favorite because it's where I caught the most fish, even though I did catch a lot of fish there. It was my favorite because of the setting, because it was so peaceful and so serene and picturesque, a Louisiana bayou. It was secluded. It was lined with moss-filled cypress trees, lots of wildlife. In fact, just a few visits, trips before that, there had been a little fawn that had come down. I was by myself, had come down to the edge of the water, still spotted little fawn, had looked at me fishing out in the creek, waded off into the creek and started swimming across. And so I just kicked my trolling motor in and went over alongside that little fawn, reached out and petted him while he was swimming, and then backed off, and he crawled out the creek on the other side and turned around and looked at me for fully a minute and then walked off. And so it was things like that that really made that a special place to me. Now, a little side note right here. None of my sons-in-law grew up hunting and fishing, and I would say present company included. But we got in the boat and ran up the creek for a couple of miles and stopped at one of my sweet spots, and so I hand him a fishing rod that I've gotten prepared for him, one of my really good ones, with the admonition, now you take care of this because you've got about $250 in your hands here, so And then I decided to teach him a little bit about the different kinds of lures, the topwaters or spinner baits and plastics and crankbaits and jigs and so forth, and explained a little about what color you use and what water clarity, and showed him how to tie his lure on with an improved clinch knot, demonstrated how to cast so that you don't get a backlash, and told him what to do and what not to do if his lure got hung up. And then I returned back to the front of the boat and climbed up on my perch with the trolling motor, and we had a great time. Or at least that's what I thought. Until a few weeks later when he was giving a devotional at church and he used our fishing trip as an illustration. And I got to see and hear about our trip from his perspective, and it was considerably different than mine. He talked about how complex the gear was and said he was afraid the whole time that he was going to throw the rod and reel overboard and I was going to be upset. And he talked about how difficult it was to cast this level wind reel and how it kept getting tangled up. And he talked about how humiliating it was that I felt like I had to tie his, as he called it, his bait on his line for him. And how confusing it was to have so many different kinds and colors of lures and not knowing what to do with any of them anyway. And he ended up by saying I was embarrassed, humiliated, and couldn't wait to get back to the truck. My reaction when I heard that was, what an ingrate. I take him to my favorite fishing spot and give him some really nice gear. That's the last time I'll ever take him fishing. And it kind of made me mad. But after a little while, I started thinking about how long it had taken me to learn to cast a level wind reel without getting a backlash. And I still don't accomplish that every time. And to realize that I knew something about all of this because I grew up with it, literally. I grew up on the banks of a large river, and within no more than a 20-minute drive of my house, I could be on at least six significantly sized lakes. And so I grew up fishing. That is, when I wasn't hunting. And I have spent literally thousands of hours on the water and in the woods hunting and fishing. And so it was a large part of my life. And I realized that there are still lots of things that I don't know about hunting and fishing. And then, of course, I also reminded myself of how dumb I feel whenever I have to call one of my son-in-laws to come straighten my computer out that I've messed up. Now, I've told this kind of lengthy story for one purpose. Those who come to the Lord from the outside have a different perspective than those of us who grew up on the inside. We know the terminology, and there is terminology. We feel a sense of loyalty, maybe even a possessive ownership of the church. We pay attention to details that someone who came from the outside is not even aware of. We've heard the terminology for so long that in some cases it may no longer mean anything to us. For instance, Jesus often speaks of sin and salvation in metaphors of being lost and found. And we don't even think of that being a metaphor anymore. Luke chapter 15 contains three parables that Jesus told folks who were on the outside as well as folks who were on the inside. First three verses set that stage. And each one of these stories is about something that gets lost and then is found. He tells a story about a lost sheep, a lost coin, and a lost boy. At least that's what the third one seems to be until we look at it a little bit deeper, and it actually turns out that it's a story about two lost boys. One who knew he was lost and the other who didn't know he was lost. Which one of those two boys would you say was in the greatest peril? Jesus is going to teach us something new about lostness. He summarized his ministry as a rescue mission. Whenever, you remember when he went to the supper with that rich tax collector, Zacchaeus, and the Bible says that the people were murmuring, he's gone to be the guest of a sinner. And he turned to that crowd who was speaking, murmuring that, and he said, the Son of Man came to seek and save that which was lost. What does it mean to be spiritually lost? Is that something that's so fundamental that we don't even think about it anymore? There's two kinds of lostness, and that's what this parable is teaching us. And they really do look different. One, we might say, is a younger brother lostness, and the other is an older brother lostness. One is obvious. You make a moral wreck of your life because you're living a self-indulgent, self-centered, undisciplined, rebellious lifestyle. And that kind of lostness is filled with negative consequences and failures and regrets. And it inevitably ends up in the pig pen, even if it is a $1 million pig pen. The other is less obvious, but no less devastating. In order to recognize this lostness, this elder brother lostness, we have to first of all recognize a deeper definition of sin that Jesus gives to us. And we looked at that in our last lesson, namely putting yourself in the place of God. And there's a surprising application in this story. Until the older brother recognizes that he's lost, he'll never know he's lost. And consequently, he'll never be saved. He'll never be found. Until he recognizes his lostness. This form of lostness brings as much misery and pain into the world as the other form of lostness does. But the problem is, it doesn't look or feel like it is lostness. Let's look at the older brother and see if there are any telltale signs that would help us be able to determine this type of lostness, this older brother kind of lostness. The story that has been read numerous times to you now in our scripture reading whenever the older brother was told that his younger brother had come home and that his father had killed the fatted calf because his brother was back safe and sound, the next verse says, the older brother became angry. The older brother became angry. The first clue of older brother lostness is that when something bad happens in your world, you become angry and potentially ultimately bitter because of it. Why? We touched on it last lesson. Because older brothers believe that if I live a good life, God owes me a good life. When things go wrong and are obviously out of your control and you've been living a good moral life, you'll be furious with God. And so living a good life, in essence, in reality, is your means of controlling your life, controlling your environment. Elizabeth Elliot, in a book entitled These Strange Ashes, recounts an apocryphal story about Jesus. That means it wasn't included in the Bible and is almost certainly not a true story. There were many written about Jesus early after his death. But this particular story conveys a difference between self-serving service and service that comes from love. One day Jesus said to his disciples, I'd like for you to carry a stone for me. He didn't give any explanation. So the disciples looked around for a stone to carry. And Peter, being the practical sort, sought out the smallest stone that he could find. After all, Jesus didn't give any regulations for weight and size, so he put the stone in his pocket. Jesus then said, follow me. And he led them on a journey. About noontime, Jesus had everyone sit down. He waved his hand, and all of their stones turned to bread. And he said, now it's time for lunch. Well, obviously, Peter was through with his lunch in a few seconds. And when lunch was over, Jesus told him to stand up, and again he said, I'd like for you to carry a stone for me. This time Peter said, okay, I understand. I get it. So he looked around and he saw a small boulder. He hoisted it up on his back and it was painful. It made him stagger. He could hardly walk, but he said, I can't wait for supper time. Jesus then said, follow me. And he led him on a journey. Peter barely was able to keep up all afternoon. And around supper time, Jesus led them to the side of a river. And he said, now everyone throw your stones into the water. And they did. Then he said, follow me. And he began to walk. Peter and the others were looking at one another and at him dumbfounded, and Jesus stopped and turned around and said, do you not remember what I asked you to do? Who were you carrying the stone for? Like Peter, older brothers expect our goodness to pay off. And if it doesn't, there's confusion and there's anger. If you feel like you've led a really good life, then you're angry at God. If you know that you haven't led a very good life, then you're angry at yourself. And if you're not sure if you've led a good enough life, you're angry at God for a while and you're angry at yourself for a while. Thank goodness it is not our morality that earns our righteousness. If you think goodness and morality is a way to merit a good life from God, sooner or later you're going to feel cheated. It's going to happen in your life. You'll see someone who's doing better than you are in some aspect of your life, and you will say, why this person and not me? After all, look at what I've done. And this resentment is your own fault. Because you think God owes you because of your goodness. And so one of the clues of older brother righteousness is anger and hostility in your life. A second clue is a strong sense of superiority. Listen to him as he talks to his father. He starts out, look, I have done so and so. And then he will say, this son of yours. Think of who he's talking to. The comparison with others is how older brothers feel significant. It still is. And interestingly, we don't pick somebody who's more moral than we are. We pick someone who claims to be, but is obviously not. Spirituality is measured by older brothers by how many people you're willing to condemn. And in all honesty, there is a sense of obligation that older brothers feel to pass judgment on others. It's just part of what we're supposed to do. Everybody has to jump through our hoops. Everybody has to measure up to our standards. Everybody has to be as good as I am, and that's not going to happen if I can help it. The Lord gave some really serious warnings about merciless judging, didn't he? If you judge others without mercy, he said, then I'll judge you without mercy. Elder brother righteousness creates unforgiving, unloving, judgmental people who are very religious. You see, it's easy to condemn people who do things that you would never do. If someone struggles with the same sin that you do, you'll cut them some slack. But if they struggle with a sin that you don't particularly struggle with, then you're quick to condemn them if you're an older brother. And you'll draw them out of your circle. And so a strong sense of superiority quite often follows older brother righteousness and lostness. And a third clue, and there are others, but we'll just look at these three. Obedience is rooted in joyless fear. Not love. All these years, he told his father, I have slaved for you. This is not to say that duty and responsibility is not a part of our faithfulness. It is. But the word slave, him using the word slave, denotes no joy, no love, only what's required, responsibility, duty, obligation. That's all he saw. A slave obeys out of fear, fear of the consequences. Obedience born of fear does nothing to root out the fundamental cause of evil in the world, namely self-centeredness of the human heart. It does nothing to combat that. And that's why in the Old Testament it kept saying, God kept saying, the day is coming, the time is coming when I will write my laws on their hearts. On their hearts. Their righteousness will be from the inside out. It won't just be the externals of keeping law. True righteousness is more than external obedience. You remember that I started out this lesson by saying that there are three stories that Jesus told that were about something that got lost and then was found? Well, actually, that's not quite true. Because when Jesus ends the story right here, there is still one thing that is lost. The sheep has been found. The coin has been found. The younger son has been found. But there's still one thing that's still lost. Do you suppose he'll ever realize that he's lost? And do you suppose that he will ever realize how much his father loves him? And how much his father wants him to come and share in the family feast? And do you suppose he'll ever change his attitude about his brother? And about the life that he has with his father? At his father's house? With his family? Do you suppose he'll ever realize that? While we stand and sing.